Session number 10601, rule 4.
Mr. Cottier, Reel 4.
You were describing the story of Anderson, Private Anderson, who we didn't complete, so perhaps you'd like to continue with that story.
Well, this was a chap who served with me at Fenham Barracks. He was in my squad, Anderson. And, of course, he joined the battalion with me. And after a few months, he started getting himself into trouble. But there's one day, we got a call, at least my lance corporal, Corporal Thornton, got a call to say that there was a soldier lying on his bed with his rifle pointing to the door with a round up the spout, threatening anyone who came in, he would shoot. And this lance corporal Thornton dealt with the situation. He walked in and took the rifle from him. And, of course, placed him close arrest. And that night, I was on cells duty. It was my job to make sure that all equipment was removed from his cell, with the exception of his two blankets, and it was placed outside the door as a safety precaution against attempted suicides. And when I went to this particular cell to do this, I found Anderson hanging by the neck. He'd fastened his kit bag rope from the bars and stepped off the bed.
Was he unconscious at that point?
He was unconscious at that point. I lowered him down and went for assistance. And in turn, they went across to the medical room. And a chap called Gunn, a medical orderly, came across and performed artificial respiration on him. He recovered. And of course, he was dispatched to the hospital. And that's the last we heard of him.
What did you feel about finding a hanged man in the cell?
Well, at the moment, not really much. But a couple of days after, it seemed to disturb me somewhat.
Did you know that he had recovered at that time?
Oh, yes, he recovered within minutes, more or less, when this chap, performed the artificial respiration. I saw the reaction of the artificial respiration. He sort of jumped, you know, the muscular reaction. You could tell he was coming round. He's coming back to life, sort of thing. But it was disturbing a few days after when I thought about it again. Of course, I had to go before inquiry, you know, and that didn't help.
What sort of things were asked at the inquiry?
Mostly appertaining to my duties. What time did I enter the cell? You know, why did I enter the cell? And that was about all.
Did you ever hear anything more about the results of the inquiry?
No, we never heard a thing. Well, I don't know whether he was discharged from the army or... Apparently he must have had a bit of a brainstorm, mental breakdown, obviously. But that's the last we heard of it.
Mm-hmm. You've given me a fair list of duties that you had to do as a regimental policeman. Can you think of any others, apart from the ones that you've already mentioned?
We used to escort men into the colonel's office, what you call orderly room. This used to take place at 2 o'clock every afternoon. Men who had been remanded by their company commanders to appear before the colonel on charges of various descriptions. And they'd assemble outside the orderly room, under supervision of the provost sergeant, to be marched in, and we used to escort them in, and we should stand there and listen to the evidence being given and the sentence being given and march out with them, you see. But according to all order room duties.
Would these men have been kept in the cells beforehand, or would they just have to report to
Not necessarily, no. It all depends on the charge. In most cases, they would just report at 2 o'clock on the sound of the bugle, of course. The bugle would sound orderly room. Of course, they were always there in advance. The only time they came from the cells is if they were in for a drunk or more serious offences. Then we used to prepare them for the orderly room.
You said you used to prepare them for the orderly room. In what way?
Well, if you had a chap who was being detained for drunkenness or anything at all, he had to appear very ceremoniously. Polished boots, creasing his trousers, because it was a CEO's parade, a scalier parade, and we had to make sure that he was properly dressed. You couldn't just take him up in any old fashion.
Can you tell me a little bit about the sorts of problems that you came across in your old regimental policeman? You mentioned drunkenness. Was this a fairly common occurrence?
That was the main thing, drunkenness. You see, we manned the guard room 24 hours a day on 3-shift system. 6 a.m, 2 p.m, 2 to 10 at night, then from 10 to 6 in the morning again, complete circle. And the 2 to 10 man, about 9 o'clock at night, would make himself present at the door with the book, you know, checking them coming back in. And what you looked for was drunkenness. Or if a man was been out wearing his dress uniform, it wasn't disarranged in any way. He hadn't left his kappa somewhere, you know. Because that would return to barracks properly dressed just as well as they were leaving barracks. And if they didn't come properly dressed, you wouldn't know the reason why. And you would stand at the door with the book and just tick them off as they came in, jot the time down, because you practically knew everybody at this stage by name and rank. And you check them in. Now, the entrance to the barracks was an archway with 2 iron gates about 10 foot high. Now, at 9 o'clock at night, these gates were locked. And the only way you could gain entrance was through a small wicket gate, which is built in the steel structure of the gates. And this was rather a very small place to get through. You had to stoop in the first place, turn sideways to get in, even normally, so that if a man had had a couple of pints over the top, it was all the more difficult. And that was a testing point. You'd stand at the door and watch him come through the wicket gate, and that was the first instinct you got that he had too much. And of course, if you thought it warranted him being detained, you said, well, come inside, turn your pockets out. He turned his pockets out, took off his cigarettes and matches and any money he had, put them in an envelope. So, right, come on. He took me along to one of the cells.
How many cells were there?
There was 3. Then we had a big, what do you call it, a loose box. So he took me along to one of the cells. That's if they weren't already occupied by detention prisoners. But if they were occupied by detention prisoners, then you put them in the loose box, which were, there was 4 beds. Now then, if he behaved himself, and if he give you no trouble during the night, the next morning, you'd let him go. The object was, you didn't want a drunken man going into a barrack room, 9, 10 o'clock at night, causing a rumpus, upsetting other soldiers. So you more or less detained him for his own benefit. And if he wasn't too bad in his best behaviour during the night, then you just released him next morning and you didn't render charges. But But on the other hand, if he's obstructive or resisted arrest, then you did charge him, you detained him, because a man who's drunk, before he can be charged, or before he can go before the common officer, he's got to be detained at least 24 hours. This enables him to sober up before he faces the colonel, you see. He goes in sober mind. So therefore, you've got to keep him if you intend preferring charges. But if you don't, you just release him next morning, you see.
Was there a sort of group of people within the battalion that were known to be liars?
Yes, very much so. We had about 6 or 7 particular characters. Now, these men were all old soldiers, served in India, served in the Northwest Frontier, and the only thing they were afraid of was closing time. The lip for the beer. And I can name them. There was Fitzpatrick, Ginger Murray, Jocko Davis, Dacca Quinn, a lad called McGarrigle. And sure enough, you could bet your bottom dollar that when they went out, they would go in their cells. To such a point, on a Saturday night or a Sunday night, before they went out of barracks, they should report to the guard room, and when they reported, they should fetch the blankets with them, because they knew when they come back, they're going to go inside. Now then, in most cases, those lads were released next morning because they were good soldiers, very good. And you always found that where you got lads like that, who were perpetual drunks, more or less, they never came up on any other charge. Therefore, we just used to release them. Because on the whole, let's face it, they were good soldiers, they had a night out, and we used to lock them up to prevent them from causing further disturbance, and more or less no own interest. As I say, if they got obnoxious a little bit, or troublous during the night, because some cases they were keep ringing the bell, wanting to go to the toilet, because there was no toilets in the cells. Then we say, oh, this is it, you know, okay, and goes the charge. But as I say, I had to detain him for 24 hours before we'd take him before the colonel.
Did you find the new recruits more of a problem than these more seasoned soldiers who'd been in the army for a long time, knew the ropes?
Well, the recruits was only a problem in the sense that they weren't familiar with the rules and regulations. Petty things. You know, for instance, when we stand at the guard room entrance, watch them come through this little hatch. We should watch for anyone who was bringing beer into barracks. Well, that's an offence. You're not allowed to bring beer into barracks. Well, some of these lads didn't know that, and they thought they'd have a last drink sitting around the bed before they went to bed. They weren't aware of the fact that they weren't allowed to bring beer in, you see. Now, in that case, we would take the beer from them, charge them, because the offence was only maybe 3 DCB. It wasn't much of an offence in the first place. And to charge them, it was making them known among the rest of the colleagues that this was an offence. Probably got 3 DCB for it. And when we took them before the colonel, you used to march in with the evidence in your hand, the bottle of beer. When you give your evidence, you sort of held the bottle up, you see. The colonel probably said, right, I bought it 3 DCB. And the first thing you did when you came out the office, you took them back into the guard room, you got the bottle of beer, and you teamed it down the sink. Otherwise, we'd be accused of drinking ourselves. But as I say, the young soldiers, it was all little things.
Did you come across any real villains, people who were real recidivists and didn't seem to respond to the sort of punishments that were handed out?
No. We always found that once a man had been sentenced to CB or detention, he behaved himself to a point whereby I've never known a man serving detention to get PD number one. Now, PD number one is known as punishment diet, bread and water, which can be awarded to him by the colonel for any misdemeanour which he might perform during his sentence. And another thing, if you got a chap who maybe got 3 weeks detention, 21 days, he could, on good behaviour, get a remission of 7 days. He could claim a third of his sentence. So again, that was a great deterrent. It encouraged him to behave himself while he was in detention. And we didn't have much any trouble really in that respect. They behaved themselves, they did what they were told, and they got another punishment.
You mentioned drunkenness and sort of petty misdemeanours that might have come out of ignorance more than anything else as being common offences. Were there any others? Was fighting a problem? Did you?
No. On odd occasions, you'd get a bit of a heated argument in the canteen. And that's why we had to visit the canteen occasionally, when we liked, as a matter of fact, during the canteen hours. And we should look for that sort of thing. You might get a couple of chaps getting a bit heated up. But as soon as ever we made an appearance, it quietened down. You see, whereas if we didn't make an appearance, it might get worse. And, we never at any time were called into the canteen to settle any disputes. Not in peacetime. In wartime, we're often called into the pubs, track them out, you know, and put them into the wagon, take them back, but not in peacetime. Because I think in peacetime, the freedom was so much, they didn't want to lose their freedom. And they knew that once we laid a finger on them, they were for it. And furthermore, you see, if we made an arrest of any particular nature, that soldier behaved himself right from the very beginning, once you cautioned him. Because as well as you taking him up on the charge and him getting detention or CB, you were also his executioner. You were the man who was going to supervise him during his punishment. So that if he gave you any trouble during the arrest, he knew that you would later on thick and heavy when he did get his punishment. So that was another deterrent, you see. We held all the trump cards, really. And that's why we had very little bother. We never used it to any extent, you know, but we knew it was there and they knew it was there. And we're more or less jury, judge and executioner, you see.
Before the war did break out, did you have any instances of people going absent without leave? Is that common?
Odd occasions.
What procedure would you follow in those circumstances?
Well, then what used to happen, a chap would have a pass to go out, maybe a weekend pass, 7 day pass, whatever it was, you see. Now, that man didn't turn up at Rivali next morning, because in the battalion, when you got a pass, your pass was made out until Rivali, not 12 o'clock midnight like it was at the depot, until Rivali, or required for duties that day. Now then, when Rivali came, it was the orderly sergeant's job, or the orderly corporal's job, to call the roll every morning at Rivali. And he knew that Private so-and-so was on furlough and he was due to return on Monday morning at Rivali. And he called the roll and that man didn't answer his name. Then he was marked down as absent. You see? Now, when the man did return to barracks, either voluntary or maybe under civil police, if he returned under civil police, then we apprehended him in the cells. But if he returned voluntary, he went about his normal duties until such times as he was dealt with by the colonel, you see. And depending upon the circumstances of his absenteeism, the colonel would award him maybe CB or detention accordingly. Then we took him in hand then. But we didn't have any jurisdiction over the absenteeism. In that respect, it was the orderly sergeant who discovered the absenteeism, you see.
Mm-hmm. And you had nothing to do with the apprehension of people who weren't absent without leave, unless they were brought to you, as it were?
Yes, unless they were brought to us by the police. Maybe getting involved with the police, and they had locked them up and they'd brought them back. You see, then we should detain them on such times as the police evidence arrived.
Did you ever have any soldiers who ran away?
Not that I remember. Not at Woking. We did have later on, during the war. But not at Woking. I don't recall any soldiers running away. And even there was very little absenteeism. You'd probably get a young lad involved with a girl, you know, and she didn't want me to go back, things like that. Or he'd get drunk with his mates and miss the train or something. The absenteeism wasn't really intentional. He didn't go on furlough with the intention of not coming back. It was just misfortune that he didn't.
Can you tell me what you thought of the Provost Sergeant, Maguire?
Well, as a Provost Sergeant, he was first class. But as a man, he was anything but.
Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, he's a very devious type. We never knew exactly where he was any hour of the day. He would come and walk into the guard room at maybe 1 o'clock in the morning, and we didn't know where he'd sprung from with his rubber-soled shoes. And he seemed to know everything about everything. He had a foresight. He seemed to anticipate. He could nose out trouble. And he always prepared to meet that trouble.
Can you give any instances of that?
Well, I'll give you one instance where I remember he said to me one night, about 10 o'clock, come with me. And of course, as I say, he's a very devious man. He didn't tell me what was. I just followed him. And we ended up at the back of the barracks, the rear gates, which were locked at 9 o'clock at night. Little big iron gates, about 10 foot high, spiked on the top. And when we got to the gates, we positioned ourselves either side with our backs to the wall. And I still didn't know what was going on until I heard the voices from the outside make an approach to the gates. Then, of course, I discovered what was happening. It was somebody trying to break into barracks, which is an offence. Approached the gates, these two men. And there were two of the diehards, Fitzpatrick and Jocker Davis. I recognised them by their voices because as they were climbing the gates, they were talking to themselves and talking to each other and grunting and groaning as they were getting over the top. Then they came down on the inside and decided to walk towards the barrack room, and they started singing Tiptoe Through the Tulips. Then Maguire stepped out and he said, right, tiptoe to the guard room. But the idea was they were carrying beer, you see, and they knew that if they came in the front, they'd be caught for carrying beer into barracks, which again was an offence. And of course, near enough, sure enough, quite quietly, they went to the guard room, left the beer on the table. Of course, they were charged and they went back to the barrack room. But that was the sort of thing. Now, he must have known that they were on the way with the intentions of going in the back gates, but how he would know is difficult to tell.
Did he ever give you any advice on how to do the sort of job that he was doing? Did he ever talk to you?
No, it's a question of watch me. He never said, no, we'll do this or we're going to do that. Or if this happens, it was just a question of follow me and take notice, you see. You never got any instructions and you just had to fall in line. But he was a man, he was very smart, fingernails manicured, and you never saw him sitting down very much. He all stood up because I think he was afraid to spoil the crease in his trousers. Of course, he had to be smart. He had a very quiet nature about him, never shouted, never raised his voice, very quiet natured. I remember when sometimes you'd supervise detention men, scrubbing floors, his main theme was put some more water on. You know, he had a deep, quiet voice. He never got perturbed, even in a crisis, you know, with the drunks. And to me, that was stimulating. You know, he never created any anxiety. He never made mountains out of molehills. If there was a trouble in the canteen, anything like that, he used to go casually to it and deal with it, and that was it. As I say, he's very sly, devious. Typical Provost sergeant.
What did you think of the other regimental police you were working with? I think you said there was four in all. Is that correct?
Yeah, there was four on the establishment. But of course, what employ, as you might call, part-timers to meet the demand. But actually, there was four on the establishment. Because after all said and done, we had a three-shift system. Then we had a man at the gate.
Always.
From 6 o'clock in the morning to 10 o'clock at night. Then we had a man inside on the exchange, 24 hours a day. Then you had men supervising defaulters. You had the men supervising detention working. You had men doing escort to Aldi Room. You had men patrolling the barracks. So we had a staff of about 9 or 10. But there was only four on the establishment, actually. I mean, in the outbreak of war, those other men were surplus to establishment. But to stick to our four men at the break of war, you see, because their men were required in their normal duties as soldiers in the companies, you see.
Well, what did you think of the other regimental policemen which were on the establishment?
Pardon?
What did you think of the other regimental police who were on the establishment with you, who were in the guard room, as it were, with you?
Well, you know, pretty average. I mean, we got on well together. We didn't very much work together because in most cases you worked singly. Man on the gate, the man on the switchboard, you know, and man patrolling. You never worked in pairs like the normal civil police. Not in peacetime. Therefore, you didn't work very much together. Question just relieving each other from duties. And of course, you slept in the same barrack room. Bed by bed, you know, and you ate at the same table as them, and conversation was just general. You know, there was, you got on fairly well together.
Did you have any privileges as regimental police?
Well, no, not really. You were more or less under one command, the sergeant, the provost sergeant. You weren't bullied around from sergeant to sergeant like the ordinary duty soldier was. You weren't on fatigues. You didn't go on route marches. You didn't have to do PT. You were strictly a police.